But this morning we're going to continue our study in the book of Hebrews. We've been looking at, the first couple of chapters and the first chapter again in review. What's the first chapter primarily about? Christ as God. Higher than the angels. And in chapter 2, we find Christ as man made lower than the angels for the suffering of death. Chapter 3, with those things in mind, we find that Paul begins, "Wherefore, holy brethren, partakers of the heavenly calling, consider the apostle and high priest of our profession, Jesus Christ, who was faithful to him that appointed him, as also Moses was faithful in all his house." And we see Christ here in chapter 3 presented as greater than Moses. Not just, greater than Moses. Because the people to whom he was writing built their faith on Moses. Moses had, written the book that they had, the first five books of the Bible, the Torah. Moses had written that. So these people needed to understand Christ. A period of time had passed since the ascension, since Christ had been here. And I think it's curious that that period of time is roughly 40 years. It's about 38 years. And how long were the children of Israel's wanderings in the wilderness? 40 years. They could have entered Canaan in a short time. Within 18 months or so, 16, 18 months, they could have walked from Egypt to Canaan as the journeys went. Could have been there in that period of time. But another 38 years had passed before they were able to finally actually go into Canaan. But as they went into Canaan, we read in chapter 3, the last part of chapter 3, verse 17, "With whom was God grieved? Was it not with them that is sinned, whose carcasses fell in the wilderness? And to whom sware he that they should not enter into his rest, but to them that believed not?" So we see that they could not enter in because of unbelief. We think of that, and we think, oh, they did a terrible thing. Just suddenly made these bad choices. And, small habits have a tendency to work on us and to alter our way of life. Small habits do, and our permanent conduct. God warns us not to harden our hearts. Here in chapter 4, verse 1, "Let us fear then, a promise being left us of entering into his rest, that any of you should seem to come short of it." When God warns us not to harden our hearts, he has reference to more than the final unforgivable sin. That's not one huge step that we take. Oh yes, I'm going to sin against the Holy Spirit. Doesn't work like that. It's a lot of little steps in our lives where at the very end we finally say, I just don't want God in my life. Some did provoke. Of the prominent ones who entered the promised land from all the way in Egypt, we have Caleb and Joshua that are mentioned, but there were a few others who were also faithful. Some of the priests, and I think about, Eliezer, Phinehas, they were able to also go in. But they could not enter in. The rest of the camp could not enter in because of unbelief. And the prophet Daniel, I appreciated our lesson study this morning and the way you closed, Jerry, that unbelief is a real problem. And it causes all kinds of difficulties in our lives where if we would just like Nebuchadnezzar there in the last part of chapter 4 there in Daniel, could say, "I extol thee, God, the God of heaven, the God, the Creator God. You're going to be the ruler of my life forever." If we could only say that. But Paul, as we read here in Hebrews, was anxious, I believe, that Israel's prior experience was not relived and repeated by the readers of his letter here. Israel wandered 40 years in the wilderness. And the Israel in the days of Paul were no more ready to enter the promised land than was that group of people 1,500 years before. Jesus, in Matthew 24, had foretold events that were to come. And these events were now imminent, 38 years after the resurrection, after the ascension, nearly 40 years. These events were imminent. The city was to be destroyed. The sanctuary, the temple, was to be destroyed. Not one stone left standing upon another, it says. God had waited nearly 40 years for the people to adjust themselves to the new order of things after the cross. The new sanctuary ministry had been ratified by the blood of Christ. The old ministry had been done away. That old Aaronic ministry had been done away. It was time that its symbol, the temple in Jerusalem, should be also taken away. Israel still clung to those old ceremonies. A generation had passed since that Aaronic ministry had not become effective. It was ineffective. The sacrifices were of no use anymore. Because remember, in the sanctuary, that curtain torn from top to bottom at the crucifixion, nothing that happened in there had any efficiency anymore. The blood of Christ was the blood that was effective now. But the Jews still adhered to that old temple and that old service. And to Paul, the parallel between Israel of old and that at the present was clear but also ominous. What was going to happen to God's people? Now, I know that we read in Acts 13:46, what was that, this last appeal that was made to the Jews? And then in verse, where is it? Let's look over there. Acts 13:46. Paul and Barnabas, it says, waxed bold and said, it was necessary that the word of God should first have been spoken to you, the Jews. But seeing that ye put it from you and judge yourselves unworthy of everlasting life, lo, we turn to the Gentiles. What a rebuke. And I like verse 42, actually, when the Jews were gone out of the synagogue. What day was this? It was on the Sabbath. When the Jews were gone out of the synagogue, the Gentiles besought that these words might be preached to them the next Sabbath. They wanted to come back and hear more and more. Now, when the congregation was broken up, many of the Jews and religious proselytes followed Paul and Barnabas, who, speaking to them, persuaded them to continue in the grace of God. And the next Sabbath day came almost the whole city together to hear the word of God. But when the Jews saw the multitudes, they were filled with envy and spake against these things which were spoken by Paul, contradicting and blaspheming. And then we read that last sentence there, lo, we turn to the Gentiles. Would Israel here, nearly 40 years later, repeat the failure of the fathers? There was every indication that they would. Was this statement here in Acts 13:46, was that the children of Israel, as a nation, had sealed their fate in Acts 13:46? The appeal was to people as individuals, come, come, and the church grew by leaps and bounds. How many were added to the church in a day? 3,000. And here in Acts 13, nearly the whole city came out to hear the gospel being preached. But here in the book of Hebrews, Paul recounts to the Jews that were there reading his letter Israel's experience as they came out of Egypt. And he tells them to beware lest they also fall into this unbelief and fail to enter God's rest. In spite of their careful adherence to the letter of the law, Israel's failure properly to regard the Sabbath was one of the chief reasons for the failure. And we can read about that in Ezekiel chapter 20. God there says, I am the Lord that sanctify them. Remember my Sabbaths, because I am the Lord that sanctify you. So the Sabbath comes with a meaning. It's not just a day where you stop whatever you were doing the day before and put your feet up on the sofa. The Sabbath comes with the meaning of sanctification. It's tied with it. And so when we come to church week by week, when we worship here week by week, it's not just so we can come and bump elbows with someone. It's a realization that God has given us something special in the Sabbath, something special, a reminder of our sanctification, of our salvation in the Sabbath. We don't worship on the Sabbath because we have to. And we've read from Exodus chapter 20. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Don't work on the Sabbath. Learn something about the rest that comes with the gospel. It's inherent with the gospel. Resting. Has that meaning of the Sabbath changed for us today? Can we just set it aside and say, well, that was Old Testament, that was old law, that was given in the Torah. It's no longer relevant to us. No. And Paul here in Hebrews chapter 4 brings us it's important for us to understand what is here in Hebrews chapter 4. Many people say, well, you can read the 9 commandments elsewhere in the Old, in the New Testament, but the Sabbath commandment? No. Well, Paul says, now, here, let's talk about this. So let's go ahead and read here chapter 4, Hebrews chapter 4. Let us therefore fear, lest a promise being left us of entering into his rest, any of you should seem to come short of it. For unto us was the gospel preached, as well as unto them, but the word preached did not profit them, not being mixed with faith in them that heard it. For we which have believed do enter into rest, as he said, as I have sworn in my wrath, if they shall enter my rest, although the works were finished from the foundation of the world. For he spake in a certain place of the seventh day on this wise. What day? The Sabbath, seventh day. And God did rest the seventh day from all his works, and in this place again, if they shall enter my rest. Rest was in the inheritance of the land. Inheriting the land wasn't the point, but inheriting the rest that's required to obtain the land is Paul's object here, and was God's object also. Possession of the land came as a natural consequence of learning how to rest. Paul discusses God's rest that Israel failed to enter, and he connects it with the seventh-day Sabbath. This New Testament reference, made nearly 40 years after the ascension, and we hear people say, oh, well, we don't know anything about keeping the Sabbath after the crucifixion. Oh, yes, there were a few instances. And so, well, yeah, you know, for 3 years, Paul preached, and they kept the Sabbath. You know, you can keep track of that. But here, nearly 40 years later, Paul emphasizes the importance of worshiping on the Sabbath. 40 years. It's not the question of a day, merely, but of a life of dedication and holiness is what comes into being here. The life Israel of old rejected, which it also shown was a sign of it, their sanctification, was also rejected. The Sabbath. And there's a danger that we too may do the same thing today. And many do just that. This phrase, the promise being left, is an interesting phrase there in verse 1. Therefore let us fear lest a promise being left. That little phrase is, you may have heard of the aorist in the Greek. It's in the aorist present active tense. It marks a present and continuous leaving behind, and also a present and continuous invitation to enter. Paul says, it's there. Come, come, come. God is calling. The promise had been continually present. The rejection had also been continually present. Each generation had rejected that promise, and in that rejection, each generation had closed its probation. Paul's generation was about to do the same. But while there was still time, God said, I've got to make one more attempt for these people. One more attempt. The door was still open, and the promise was still left, but there was no time to lose. The dispersion was imminent. Jerusalem was about to fall. Everything they had was about to be gone. They were in danger of coming short of God's rest, as Israel of old had done. This God would prevent if he could, but could he? Does God force himself on us? Does he force you to rest? No. Whose rest was it that he wanted them to enter into? His rest. God's rest. Not our rest. Not the kind of rest that we think about. It wasn't that resting, you know, on the couch with your feet propped up. And that's actually the word here. Is kataposis. Is that reclining on a sofa with your feet propped up. Is that important? We need rest. We need physical rest, but we also need spiritual rest. Rest from the work that we do day by day. Rest from our attempts to save ourselves. God says, enter into my rest. His rest. Not rest in general, but the rest of God. The glad tidings there in verse 2. The gospel was preached unto us as well as unto them. And it had been preached to them through types and ceremonies, rituals. The fathers of the children of Israel had received instruction, ample instruction. They had received the gospel in all of those things. But there was a problem. There in verse 2, as well as unto them, but the word preached did not profit them. Why not? Who was it that did not profit, the preacher or the listener? The listener. The listener did not profit them in their ears. It was the listener. It was the hearers where the problem was. The word was not mixed with faith in the listener's ears. Well, I wonder sometimes about the effectiveness of preaching, especially when I stand here. Success in preaching does not always depend upon the speaker. I hear some speakers that stumble and mutter, but they have a message. They have a message. It may not depend on the preacher at all. You know, even Christ was limited by what he could do. He preached for 3.5 years, but he was limited by the receptiveness of his hearers. And in Matthew 13, we read, he did not many mighty works there because of their unbelief. Same story. And so we say, well, Christ wasn't a very good preacher. Well, no, that wasn't the problem. It's possible for the hearers completely to nullify the preaching. There are times when the pulpit is less to blame than the pew, so you guys listen. But it's true, isn't it? We come with our own preconceptions. We come with our own thoughts in our mind. And when the day hasn't gone well, we tend to throw blame on the preacher for the meager results that we have in evangelism. Now, this may be the place for blame sometimes. Many preachers, I also find, have no real message. There are many today also who should be preaching, perhaps, instead of following the plow, whatever you want to call it. Then again, there are many preachers who would do more for humanity if they would engage in some other line of work. It's true that there is equal responsibility for unsatisfactory results. I think of Noah. He preached for, 120 years? A preacher of righteousness, we're told, and only 8 souls got on the ark. Was Noah a poor preacher? I don't think so. Persuaded only 7 people to go on the ark with him. A small result for 120 years of preaching. I wonder how long he would remain on the payroll if he were one of our evangelists today. We most certainly need better preachers, but we also most certainly need better hearers. And for those of us sitting here today, the counsel is, let us therefore fear, lest a promise being left us of entering into his rest, any of you should seem to come short of it. That's us. The last verse last bit there in verse 3, affirms that Israel could not enter in. Not because of what God was doing or what God perhaps had omitted, but because of unbelief again. When was God's rest complete? From the foundation of the world, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. Or from even before the foundation of the world, we read it in another place. The rest that the believer is called to is not merely the kind of rest that I think of. It's not a rest, it's the rest with the definite article. Now here in the King James, it doesn't use that the rest with the definite article, but in the original that is implied there. The rest of God, points out clearly that it is God's rest that we're talking about there in verse 1. Moses didn't bring Israel in. Joshua did bring the children of Israel into Canaan, into the literal land of Canaan, but not into God's rest. And as we read farther along here in chapter 4, we find that to be the case. God had made all calls and made every effort that he could to get the children of Israel to follow him in his rest. Even in Paul's day, his house was not yet filled. There was room for others to enter, and they did enter, and that's the Acts 13 experience. Others, the Gentiles, were called, and they came in by the thousands. Now, some of those were Jews also that came in, but many of the Gentiles came in by the thousands. The thought here in verse 3 is that they which have believed are entering into God's rest. But of the others who believe not, God has sworn that they shall not enter into his rest. Now, from the very beginning of the creation of this world, God had in mind to provide rest for his people. Wasn't that what was the promise in Eden even? Was the restoration of the land, of rest, of so many things that God wanted Adam and Eve to be restored to. God did not call Adam and Eve into being merely to present them with a life of toil. On Friday afternoon, they were created. We think of all the animals and stuff. That was done first. And then God bends down, Jesus bends down in the dirt, forms man after his own image, bends over, breathes into him the breath of life, and man became a living soul. At the end of that day, Adam was created. At the end of that day, Eve was created. At the end of that day, God passed the animals before Adam, and names were given to the animals, and God smiled and said, "Yes, it is very good. This man, he has my mind. We think alike." And God was pleased, and at the end of the sixth day, he looked around and said, "It is very good." And man rested. Man's first full day on this earth was a day of rest, not a day of work. God said, "Yes, there is work, but it's not the kind of work that you think. It's not labor to save yourselves from sin. It's rest in me." Mm-hmm. And the work that you then do, the trimming of the bushes and keeping the cows and the sheep, and yes, that is labor, but it's not the kind of labor that we often think of today. Jesus counseled us there in Matthew to come unto me, all you that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. What kind of rest did God want these people to call and come to? Rest and freedom from sin, which is a symbol of the Sabbath, the sign and seal of rest. Paul uses this fact to prove that God, from the very beginning, had in mind to provide his creatures with fullness of life, a complete, satisfying life, which included labor. God says, stay busy, but don't just busy for the object of being busy. I think a lot of times we do that too. He says there's work to be done. In their wilderness wanderings, in those 40 years, they saw little promise of rest. They wandered and wandered. Year after year went by, and still they were on the march. In Egypt, they had homes. They had a place to raise their children. Had comparative peace, really. Yeah, they had to work. They had to work hard. They had their flesh pots. They had their leeks and onions. They had the garlic. And when they were out there in the wilderness, they said it would be better for us to go back to Egypt than to wander out here with God, whoever that might be. Send us back to Egypt, Moses. We're better off over there. If this is all that God has to offer us, we'd rather go back to Egypt. But God had promised them rest, but there was no rest in sight. Why did God not lead them directly into the promised land? Well, they were spiritually unprepared. And that was part of the journeying process, was to learn about God. He says, "You don't have water? Okay, I can give you water. You don't have food? Okay, I can give you food. The leather on your sandals, it's not going to wear out. Your clothes aren't going to become rags. I can take care of all that." And then he said, "Let them build me a sanctuary. Let them make me a sanctuary, that I might dwell among them." You need to learn about me. You've been 400 years over there with the Egyptians. It's time to learn about me now. Their entrance to Canaan was dependent upon their willingness to follow Christ. This was the central point of their situation. God would give them rest from their wanderings as they learned how to rest with Him. As soon as they had rest in their souls, they would be able to rest in the promised land. And the assurance was given them in Exodus 33, verse 14, "My presence shall go with thee. I will give you rest." The promise was rest. And this was the rest that Jesus meant when he said there in Matthew 11 again, "Come unto me, all you that labor and are heavy laden. I will give you rest." This was the call that came to Israel at the time of the captivity. In Jeremiah 6, "Stand you in the ways and see the old paths." Well, let's see here. Jeremiah, let's turn back over there. Keep your finger here in Hebrews. Go back to Jeremiah. Jeremiah chapter 6. God talking to the children of Israel. Jeremiah 6, verse 16. "Thus saith the Lord, stand ye in the ways and see and ask for the old paths. Where is the good way? And walk therein." God was calling them to rest. Follow the good way and walk therein, and ye shall find rest for your souls. But they said, we will not walk therein. Turn a page, chapter 8, verse 5. Well, verse 4, moreover, thou shalt say unto them, thus saith the Lord, shall they fall and not arise? Shall he turn away and not return? Why then is this people of Jerusalem slidden back by perpetual backsliding? They hold fast deceit. They refuse to return. Persistent, stubborn unbelief was the problem. Persistent, stubborn unbelief. But here in the book of Hebrews, Paul says there is rest for the soul. This was the rest that God would bring them into. God was chiefly interested in that rest and in returning them to that rest. But the people, they really didn't care about that. They were chiefly interested in getting into the land of Canaan and finding rest from their wanderings. They didn't care about the rest of God. But the condition for this rest was rest in God. Put down the swords. Put down your weapons. I'll take care of you. I will give you rest. Rest for your sin-laden, weary souls. The thought continually came to the mind of the children of Israel in the wilderness. Will God ever bring us into the promised land? We've been in the wilderness 10, 20, 30 years. Will we ever go in? Here we are just as far from Canaan as we ever were. 40 years. Are we all to die here? Will we never get in? Will we never gain our rest? Micah had something to say about that. Micah 6. Can you find Micah? That's not one we turn to very often. I've got three or four pages here in my Bible. Micah chapter 6. And I'm reminded of that statement written in 1901. It's recorded for us in the manuscript releases, volume 20. We may have to remain here many more years because of insubordination. Persistent, stubborn unbelief is why we have been here for 175 years. As did the children of Israel, but for Christ's sake, his people should not add sin to sin by charging God with the consequence of their own wrong course of action. Now have men who claim to believe the word of God learned their lesson, that obedience is better than sacrifice. He hath showed thee this rebellious people, and this is Micah chapter 6, verse 8. He hath showed thee, O man, what is good, and what doth the Lord require of thee, but to do justly, and to love mercy, and to walk humbly with thy God. That was the lesson Nebuchadnezzar learned in chapter 4, the book of Daniel. To walk humbly before God. Yes, he stood, there is not this great Babylon that I have built, and went insane. And there at the end of the chapter it says he was returned to his right mind. I think about Jesus, you know, that who was that there? Weren't those guys on the beach, the demoniac on the beach? Running around naked and tearing at his hair and his flesh, and people were afraid of him. They ran, and, well, not unlike Nebuchadnezzar. They put chains on him. He'd tear the chains off. I thought, that's pretty incredible. People were afraid of Nebuchadnezzar out there. They watched over him, yeah, because he was the king. He was the big cheese in the family, the patriarch in the family. Yeah, they looked out after him, but at times, you know, they said, what can we do? Can we get his hair clean? No, probably not. Can we trim his fingernails? No, probably not. And so for 7 years, Nebuchadnezzar wandered in the wilderness to learn this lesson that we read here in Micah 6, verse 8, to walk humbly with thy God. Paul answers these questions for us. Will we have to remain here for many more years? Paul answers that question. Right here in verse 3, 4, 5, he said, God will give you rest. God will bring you in. And this has been God's purpose from time immemorial, to bring us in. The works were finished from the foundation of the world. And after God's work was finished, what did he do?
He rested from all the works that he had done. That's, what, Exodus 3, verse 1, perhaps? He rested. We need to yield ourselves to the fashioning hand of God, and He will give us rest. He will give you rest. We struggle. We search. We try to find rest, just like the children of Israel did, wandering in the wilderness. But God will give us rest. Rest for our sin-weary souls. Rest from our wandering. That argument Paul is now applying to his generation, his own generation. The Jews had been God's special, chosen people. But despite this, there was persistent rebellion. True, they were in the land. They had gone over the Jordan. They were in the land. But they certainly had not had rest from their enemies. And now a crisis was approaching. It's nearly 70 A.D., and this crisis was, well, something they couldn't even imagine. They doubtless did not know what we know now as we read history. They couldn't see themselves eating their own children, but they did. Would they heed the call of Jesus and come to Him and find rest for their souls? Well, as we read the history, no, they didn't. But was it too late? That's the question. Paul says, no, it's not too late. Now is the accepted time. Now, before our city is destroyed, now is the accepted time to come to Christ. Now is the time for us who have believed to enter. Others might enter also, but are you willing to enter God's rest? Or do you want to continue to wander? God gives you a choice. You have two options, wander or rest. Bring your burden to Jesus and find rest. Rest from sin and sinning. Find the true meaning of the Sabbath. Of rest. True rest. Not just going home and putting your feet up on the couch. Yes, that is rest of a type. But as we go on here in chapter 4, we'll find that Paul says, no, there's something bigger than that. Find the true meaning of Sabbath rest. Rest to your sin-burdened soul. That's Paul's thought and God's desire for each of us. Rest for our sin-burdened souls.